A wildfire forces evacuations near Superior. Good evening, I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce talks with political scientist David Parker about the wide-open U.S. Senate race. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with writer Ron Fitzgerald about the process of writing for a hit TV series. A wildfire that started near Interstate 90, about 2 miles northwest of Superior, has grown to over 700 acres and forced the evacuation of about 30 homes in the Pardee and Flat Creek areas. Fire Information Officer Pat McKelvey says homes on the north side of Mullen Road are under a pre-evacuation order, meaning they should be prepared to leave quickly. The Red Cross is setting up an evacuation center at the elementary school in Superior. The West Mullen fire started about 5 p.m. yesterday.
It's actually spotting to the north, kind of to the northeast. If you've looked at the location, you know that that is a kind of away from the interstate and away from Superior.
Hand crews, a helicopter, and air tankers are fighting the fire with more resources on the way. A Type 2 incident command team is taking over the fire this evening. McKelvey says storm systems are due to move into the area tomorrow night, could bring needed rain or just wind that could drive the fire even further. The cause of the fire is under investigation.
And in other news from around the state, former Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer shocked the political world this past weekend in announcing he will not run for the open Senate seat being vacated by Max Baucus in 2014. Schweitzer says he is not interested in moving to Washington, D.C., saying he is happy with his current position as board chairman of the Stillwater Mining Company and is content living in his new house on Georgetown Lake. Republican Congressman Steve Daines has expressed interest in running for the seat and is considered to be the new frontrunner. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce speaks with Montana State University political science professor David Parker to get his thoughts on the Schweitzer decision and the dynamics of the Senate race moving forward. Parker says he was as surprised as everyone about Schweitzer's announcement, but says he has two ideas on what may have led to it.
One is the honest-to-God truth that he said. He didn't really want to go to Washington, really didn't want to serve in the Senate, didn't really interest him. Secondly, the other reason might be is I've always thought, and a lot of people suspect he has presidential ambitions, and maybe he believed that going to the Senate wouldn't advance those ambitions, so he took a pass on it.
There have been these stories recently from, you know, Fox Business News, and John Adams from the Great Falls Tribune ran this article this weekend about tying the governor to these dark money groups and nonprofit PACs. Do you think that would have had any serious effect?
I don't think so. And here's why. I've never known the governor to shy away from a fight. So why would he run away from that particular issue, whether, you know, it's extensive or not extensive? I don't really see that as playing ultimately into his decision to say, nah, I'm not going to do this.
So Schweitzer's listed as the Democrats' best chance for that seat. Do they have a chance now?
It becomes tougher. Because I think what's going to happen, and I think every reasonable observer expects that Steve Daines is going to jump into this race. And if you don't have somebody that has a lot of resources, a strong statewide name recognition, and can run a flawless campaign, it's going to be really hard to beat a Republican candidate. They do have a little bit of an advantage, and I think Steve Daines has an advantage just coming off of running a really strong House seat. So it becomes harder. There are other candidates people have talked about, but all of them have one problem or another.
Can we talk about those candidates that you've heard so far and your reflections on them?
Yeah, so I think there are three that I've heard bandied about a lot. One is Denise Juneau, the second is Monica Lindeen, and the third is Stephanie Shriok. All of them have various issues that would be a bit more challenging to overcome that Brian Schweitzer didn't have.
Like what?
Well, let's take Denise Juneau and Monica Lindeen together. There is their advantage. They have statewide name recognition. They've run a statewide race before. That's good. That will help them. Here's the negative. They would be starting a campaign in, you know, July or August. In the last cycle, we were already well into this race, and millions of dollars have already been raised. They've got to raise all that money, and they're behind the eight ball if Steve Daines runs, because he already has some of that money out there. Another advantage they both have, though, is they don't have a legislative record that can be picked apart, at least, you know, in their statewide capacity. So that's an advantage. Steve Daines doesn't have an extensive record, but there's some votes that, you know, maybe they could quibble with here and there. So that's kind of the story Dean and Juno. Shriok, she could tap into an amazing national fundraising apparatus. Big negative, she's never run herself as a candidate. Yeah, she's run other people's campaigns, but running as a candidate is completely different. She's what we call a political amateur because she hasn't run for office before. And, you know, they're just more prone to mistakes.
So if you're the Democrats then, and hypothetically let's talk about Danes jumping into the Senate race, if you're the Democrats, do you put your best candidate against Danes, or do you put more effort into winning that House seat?
Well, that becomes a tricky calculation at the state level, but also the national implications. I would put the best candidate you can against the Senate candidate, and here's why. Because you're going into an election, it's going to be tough for Democrats because it's a six-year midterm itch, which means the president's party has a lot more trouble in those elections. The Senate's at stake. The Senate was at stake last time. It's at stake again. The prospects of the Democrats taking over the House are remote. So if you want to keep the Senate, you've got to put up your best candidate there. I think the House race is going to be very interesting because I don't have any read on that whatsoever. I mean, the way I think what's going to happen is I think Steve Daines has run for the Senate. He wanted to run for the Senate before. I think it's a no-brainer to run for an open seat. That's an easier seat to go ahead and pick up and win. So what I think is going to happen is I think those two Republican candidates that are now running for the Senate will probably move over into the House race. But for the Democrats, I think it would be wide open. I mean, see, last time could decide to run again on top of some of the statewide candidates like a Juno or a Lindeen. If they take a pass in a Senate race, might run for that House seat too.
What do you think is next for Brian Schweitzer? Is this the last the Montana political scene has heard from him?
I seriously doubt it. I mean, he definitely loves the game. He's interested in policy. He's a smart guy. I think he's going to be involved and dabbling. And, you know, I think there might even be a better chance now that he might run for president to turn down this Senate campaign. Whether that's in 2016 or 2020, I don't know.
Dr. David Parker, political science professor at Montana State University, thanks so much for your time, sir.
No problem, Dan.
Yesterday's Missoula Marathon brought runners from 48 states and 8 countries to the Garden City. Runners started at 5 a.m. and most finished before noon. Even though the marathon is over, reporter Ruth Eddy found Executive Director of Run Wild Missoula, Eva Dunfrobig, still doing a lot of running around, all in green clogs.
I have a Gatorade water jug.
Okay. Run Wild Missoula, who puts on the Missoula Marathon every year, just started renting the basement of Runner's Edge in January.
In the past, we did not have an office, so that made it really hard. This is nice that we actually have the space to do this.
Space to spread out a lot of t-shirts. Green ones for the full marathon, blue for the half, and gray for the 5K. Each shirt has men's and women's variety, and then multiple sizes of each of those.
Shirts? I would if you had a large.
Yeah.
Today, Rika Botzet is helping runners exchange their t-shirt sizes, but she's been volunteering for the marathon all weekend.
Friday night, I volunteered at the beer run. Saturday, I worked at the expo. And yesterday, I handed out medals at the finish line. I'm a little tired. I'm not like the marathon runners, but I've been standing a lot.
Over 900 people volunteered for the marathon this weekend, and Dunfrobig is happy to have volunteers for after the marathon as well.
Did you want to exchange your shirt?
No, lost and found.
Lost and found here.
Alongside piles of t-shirts, there's also a lost and found pile, which Dunfrobig says will grow throughout the week. Runners are also coming in to claim their trophies.
15 to
19
half marathon.
Chris Herrick placed first in the half marathon in the 15 to 19 age group.
Feels good. It was really fun. So, yeah, it was a great time.
And winners aren't the only ones with good things to say.
We've just been hearing so many great things from people in locals and out of town runners and out-of-town runners who are going to go back to their friends and tell them about the race and encourage them to come and participate someday.
Dunfrobig says the best way for a run to grow is by word of mouth. In order to control the growth of the race, the marathon this year put a cap on the number of entrants. She expects the committee will raise the limit a bit for next year's marathon, but doesn't plan on making any big changes because people like it the way it is.
I know people like the free photo. We give everybody a free photo of themselves in the race. and that's something that a lot of races don't offer.
She says a lot of races also don't let runners change their t-shirt sizes. The Missoula Marathon does, which had done Froebig making trips to the storage space across the street.
It's important to people. I mean, when you spend that much time training for something, you want to show the world that you did it. And if you can't wear your shirt, then what's the point?
Dunn Froebig says it's the little things like t-shirt exchanging that keep people happy and coming back year after year. Registration opens for next year's marathon on October 1st. For Montana Evening Edition, I'm Ruth Eddy.
Ron Fitzgerald has written for the hit network television series Friday Night Lights and the Showtime hit series Weeds, but he started his writing career as a playwright. Fitzgerald is in Missoula this week to participate in the annual Missoula Colony sponsored by the Montana Repertory Theater. The Colony is an annual week-long workshop for aspiring stage and screen writers. In tonight's feature interview, Fitzgerald talks with news director Sally Mock about starting his career as a playwright in New York.
And that was great, and but it doesn't feed you. And at a certain point, when I had just been struggling in New York, and enjoying the struggle, but just
at some point though, it's still a struggle, right?
Yeah. And you got to make a living. You started getting concerned. What am I going to? Have I made a horrible decision with my life? Like, what am I doing? How? I know that there are sacrifices that you make. You make choices about your life. If I choose this path over here, I'm not setting myself up so much to maybe have a family, because what are you going to do? Like, you can barely provide for yourself. You can't drag kids into this. And then when I had an opportunity, things shifted in New York for me. I had a play that was produced by Michael Imperioli's theater company, a little place called Studio Dante, that he kind of took his Sopranos money and invested in theater.
He's an actor on the great HBO series, The Sopranos.
Yeah. He played Christopher, and great, smart guy, great guy. Really gave me a huge break. And that production turned things around for me, got me noticed a little bit. I got a nice review in the Times, and all of a sudden it was like, are you interested in writing for television? And I was like, I am interested in making a living as a writer, whatever that means, because I'd written copy, on the side for as a freelance ad guy, and that's kind of where it started. And then I had the opportunity, I submitted some stuff to Weeds. They're like, do you watch the show Weeds? And I said, yeah, every week I watch
this
show.
A series that aired on Showtime.
Yep.
Big hit.
Yep. Mary Louise Parker, Jenji Cohen created it, and her, I'll give her a plug, her new show, Orange is the New Black, is coming out on Netflix, and it's supposed to be great.
I just read a really favorable review of that in The New Yorker, actually.
I'm looking for
it. They're raving about it.
Jenji's great. I mean, she's so, just her, the way she thinks about life, the way she approaches things, and just, I can't wait to see it. I just expect big things, and I'm sure they'll they'll be better. And what a great training ground for me. I mean, to go from not having any television experience to be given this opportunity to work on Weeds. And Jenji is a boss who says, go do. Get out there. Get out on set. Learn everything that's here. The doors are open. It's on you to do it. We want you to do the work. The opportunities are there. So you can sit in your office and just type if you want to be an introverted writer and not speak to anybody. But if you want to learn how these things work, how what the relationship between the actors and the crew, between the director and the cinematographer, how, if you want to figure that out, get down there, talk to the people, and make it happen.
Because you've anticipated my next question, and that is really the main difference between writing for the stage and writing for the television. You've mentioned some of it. There's a lot that goes on TV that obviously you can't do on the stage.
Yeah, I mean, it's and the brevity. I mean, you can't in theater, you're getting to these gut wrenching emotional moments, and that might take you 30 minutes in one long scene. In television, you don't have that luxury. I mean, if you're lucky enough to work in a format that is premium cable where there are no commercials, that's an advantage to a writer because you can create a different momentum. I worked on Friday Night Lights that had commercials. I loved that show. It was an honor to write on that show. I've had great network experiences too. It's just, it's different, and time is essential. You just don't have as much time as you'd like. There are things you have to adhere to, and so even though you do get now to blow things up and to cut away to that speeding car, cars and have those crazy things happen, there's also now a new rigor in terms of the time you have to do it and the velocity you have to achieve quickly.
But dialogue is still key.
But dialogue is the king. I mean, a lot of people would say, I honestly find that the my experiences in television, working with actors, being on set, working with the crews, it reminds me of theater. I mean, I think it's really collaborative. I think the best stuff is hugely collaborative. You work with writers in a room. You're all sitting around tossing out ideas, working off each other's stuff. You can't be precious about your own writing. You know, you have to be kind of like nuts and bolts about it. We got to make this work. It has to be right. If I can't do it, one of us in the room has to take a shot at this and get it done. So, you know, same thing with being on set, communicating with the actors to find the best ways. Is there a way to do this? I remember we had this idea for a scene in Weeds, and we're getting ready to shoot it, and I had a bunch of yammer yammer written in there, you know, and Mary Louise Parker is fabulous, right? Amazing actor. Comes up to me and says, you know, I know what you're after here. I think, can I show you something? I think I can do it with you know, let me just show you something. And then she goes ahead and does make some physical choices, just doing some simple things that told the entire story, the entire emotion that I was after without the words. So then you go, yes, let's do that. Let's cut what I wrote and you do your thing. And then that, I think that's, you know, great things can come out of that.
I think one of the things that mystifies me about writing for television is that there isn't a writer usually. There are several.
Yeah.
And like a playwright is a playwright. He or she writes their play.
Yep.
But a TV show has all these writers in a room or on set who are collaborating. How do you decide? How do you weed the carrot patch there?
It's, you know, it's kind of, I think there are, I've had experiences where things were very ordered and very structured, and we're like, and, you know, first we'll do this, then we'll do this, then we'll do this, and so forth, and then our cake will be baked, you know? And then there's other things where it's like, the party starts in 5 minutes. Did anybody make a cake? Did anybody know? Oh my God. And getting it done that way too. So it just comes, you just have, I think ultimately it comes down to the people there that I've been fortunate enough to work with. They're just talented people and they just love what they do. And you're in that, it's just fun. It's so much fun to bounce the ideas around and to figure out the stories and it's all about, I think, what's the best idea, not who has the best idea. It's like that best idea can come from anyone. We don't care. It doesn't matter. But let's make sure we get the best one, and let's pursue that with all of our collective talent to raise it, you know?
There's no pressure to be brilliant.
Oh, there's always. There's a lot of pressure to be brilliant because, you know, you're not going to get paid. Otherwise, you might find your career a bit truncated if the brilliance isn't there. But I think the pressure is great. I think that kind of pressure, it can be a positive because you are constantly striving to do the best version that you can do. And if you have a show, going into a show like Weeds, where I was a fan already, you know, and I'm thinking, man, I better not do something to mess this up because this is a little piece of genius here, you know, or going on to something like Friday Night Lights. I mean, this show is beloved. If I screw this up, I am a bad, bad, bad person. So, I when I approached going into those things and you really feel an obligation to sustain, you know, the greatness that's come before, it's on you to really, you know, do well. I mean, I can't imagine if having, you know, a show, going on a show like a Sopranos or The Wire or, you know, some of these great epic TV shows, I would think it would be daunting because, you know, you really got to make sure you don't drop the ball.
This is a heyday, isn't it, of television for cable, especially. All the shows you mentioned, except for Friday Night Lights, are on cable, and the standard of excellence, it seems, in television has risen in terms of some of those cable television programs. Of course, there's a lot of dreck out there as well. But still, it seems like it's a heyday, isn't it?
I think so. Across the board, there are things. There are so many different. It's rough because a place like HBO is a great place to work because there's so much freedom. So much, you know, you can really take some chances. But you look at, you know, AMC's got Walking Dead out now, right? And that's taking
some
chances.
The Killing is a great series.
The Killing, yeah. The people, I think, they're always looking to go wherever the greatness is. Sometimes it's just a little, there are restrictions when you're an advert, you know, your revenue is based on advertising. You got to you know, you have a little different, slightly different rules, I think, that you have to play by.
You're in a profession that can be lucrative, but it's also boom and bust, isn't it? I mean, the shows do go off the air eventually. Some are canceled. Some just run their natural course. And then you have no guarantee that you're going to have another hit.
The last two shows I worked on were canceled. I worked on Prime Suspect, which was an
NBC. Maria Bello.
Yeah, and talk about another great actor. Mm-hmm. I mean, that amazing cast on that show, top to bottom. I mean, I've been really, really fortunate. I can't be said enough. I don't mean to repeat myself, but I've worked with just amazing actors, and that's and amazing writers, amazing directors. But you can't overstate the importance of having that great cast that that you can feed off of. But Prime Suspect, you know, based on a great BBC show, right? And then that just didn't catch at the network. We just couldn't get the viewership up, the number of eyeballs that we needed to stay on the air. You know, in the same situation with Last Resort, you know, it's a great show, great concept, and just couldn't get there.
Do you pitch shows as well? And are you in the process of doing that?
I am, actually. I just was fortunate enough to sell a piece of a property to Homebox out to HBO. I just finished a draft of that script of the pilot for this show, and then that's now going over to them to see what they think about it. And
a drama or a comedy?
It's a drama, yeah, an hour drama. And it's kind of, for me, it involves a lot of experiences. It's almost, I guess I would call it, it's a family drama. It takes place in a small town, and could be Eastern Montana, Wyoming, coal mining town. And it's kind of it's got a Friday Night Lights for adults feel, like, without the, I loved working on Friday Night Lights. I loved delving into that high school experience. You know, what does that mean? But there's a certain, you know, on NBC, there's certain things you can't get into that you might like to get into that you think are true to life. And so in this show, I look forward to being able to get into those things as a family life of those conflicts within generations and you know, economic strife, and really being able to take an honest look at that and in a way that you can on HBO. Yeah.
Well, we hope it gets picked up.
Yeah, me too.
And we get to see it. And I have been speaking with Ron Fitzgerald, who is a television writer and also a playwright, and he's in Missoula to participate in this week's Missoula Colony, which is a week-long training for aspiring playwrights and writers. And Ron, it's just been really fun to talk to you and get a behind-the-TV-screen look at what writers actually do.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. It's always, I love coming to Missoula. I have always loved it, and I love being part of the colony here at the U. And it's just as a magical opportunity. It meant a lot to me in my career, and I think it really helped me get to where I am, and hopefully will continue to help me get further. But I'm very happy with where I am right now. I couldn't ask for more, and I never would have seen it coming.
All right. Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
To learn more about Ron Fitzgerald and this year's Missoula Colony workshops and readings, go to the website montanarep.org.
In tonight's weather forecast for west of the Continental Divide, tonight expect mostly clear skies. Lows will be in the mid-40s to lower 50s. Tomorrow calls for mostly sunny skies with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Highs will be in the 80s to lower 90s. For central Montana, tonight calls for partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain, showers, and thunderstorms. Lows will be in the 50s. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a slight chance of thunderstorms. Highs will be in the mid-70s. And for southwest Montana, tonight calls for partly cloudy skies with a chance of isolated showers. Lows will be around 50 degrees. Tomorrow expect increasing clouds with a chance of rain, showers, and thunderstorms. Highs will stick around in the upper 80s. And now for the editorial comments of Tom Power.
Montana's wildfire season continues to develop slowly, but elsewhere in the American West, the wildfire season started early and violently. By early June, wildfires were raging across Colorado, where the Black Forest Fire burned 22 square miles and destroyed almost 500 homes, leaving two dead by mid-June. Then, at the end of June, in Yarnell, Arizona, 19 hotshot firefighters died as a wildfire suddenly surrounded and trapped them. Recently, the West seems to have been doubly cursed by nature. Our wildfires are starting earlier, burning larger areas with higher intensity and lasting longer. Meanwhile, beetle infestations are leading to the death of huge swaths of our forests, leaving millions of dead trees to ultimately tumble in crisscrossed heaps on the forest floor. Of course, we know that these are not unrelated phenomena. Both have been triggered by climate change. We no longer regularly have the extremely cold winter weather that kills the beetles. The beetles now have a much longer season and multiple generations to make the forest trees their temporary homes. Drought has also plagued much of the West, while even those areas not in droughts see the snowpack disappear earlier and our forested mountains dry out more quickly. In record high temperatures, our forests simmer, waiting for lightning or human stupidity to ignite them, and ill-timed winds to whip them into a firestorm. But fire is something humans have worked on controlling ever since we began living on top of one another in urban settings. In general, we've learned to successfully control fire in the urban areas where most of us live. That success in urban settings leads us to look for human causes of the failure to act to control wildfires in our natural areas. If the current fire conditions of our forests is more dangerous than it used to be, we look for human causes. Our European folk heritage, with its worried concern about the safety of wild areas, well represented in the grim fairy tales we all learned as children, suggests one possible source of the fires threatening from our forests. As the timber industry and some forest managers put it, it has been our failure to impose human order on the chaos of wild natural systems that creates the wildfire dangers we now face. If we had brought more of those forested lands under human management by roading, logging, and managed replanting of all of those forest lands, there would be much less fuel in those forests to burn. From this point of view, it was our failure to more heavily log and thin our natural forests that is the source of current wildfire problems. If we had continued the heavy logging and thinning programs of the 1950s through the 1980s, unfettered by wilderness protection and other environmental constraints, we are told that our communities would not now be surrounded by forests with dangerous buildups of hazardous fuels that periodically burst into flames as a deadly firestorm that can overwhelm both firefighters and human settlements. Looking across our forested landscapes from this perspective, one sees almost unlimited opportunities for expanded logging and the extension of a forest road system to support it, all in the name of removing hazardous forest fuels and making us safer. It is not surprising that logging interests push commercial logging as a solution to the threat of wildfires. Despite the attempt to clothe this solution to our wildfire problems as a practical, commonsensical prescription, it is not supported by any forest or fire science. It is built around the simplistic notion that since it is trees in the forest that burn, removing the trees will stop the forest from burning. Even at the extreme where all trees are harvested, leaving no regeneration stock, we are faced with exactly what vegetation will replace the forest and how we will keep the grasslands, shrublands, and scrub forests from growing in behind the cleared forests and themselves catching fire. Some of our most destructive fires in terms of loss of human life and structure have taken place in recently harvested forest lands. Some of our most difficult to control and deadly forest fires are in scrublands of stunted trees or grass and shrublands or managed tree plantations, through all of which fires can roar with incredible speeds. The cost of managing all of our forest lands to artificially control all of its potentially flammable vegetation would be astronomical. We would have to repeatedly enter all areas and remove vegetation from them every several years. This would have to be done across huge expanses of remote and mountainous landscapes, where the cost would far exceed the value of the vegetation removed and transported away. The truth is, we cannot fireproof a forested landscape any more than we can floodproof low-lying land along rivers and coasts. We can spend hundreds of billions of dollars trying to do so, but nature almost always has its way. We cannot afford that sort of planned stupidity. Of course, there is a more effective and much less costly way to protect human life and property from wildfire, but it requires the opposite of the proposed landscape-wide logging proposed to fireproof our forests. It instead requires us to focus on the already human-dominated landscapes where most of us live, not distant wildlands, and reduce the likelihood of home ignition by more carefully managing forests immediately around us and our own yards and structures. It also means reducing the drain on public resources trying to protect all homes, even those purposely built in dangerous locations, by shifting the cost of fire control in those areas to those who choose to build there. One can already hear the howls of special interest groups insisting that economically irrational behavior in our forests has to continue to be subsidized no matter what the cost, because it is the only way to make natural forests safe. But despite the Grimm Brothers' fairy tale depictions, wild lands and nature are not the enemy. It is human arrogance and ignorance that chooses to directly fight powerful natural forces rather than to recognize and respect natural systems and make practical, limited adjustments where people live.
Tom Power is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. Views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetich. Thanks for listening, and please join us tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.